Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for joining me. This is a story about monastic life gleaned from a Benedictine monk with a strong sense of spiritual curiosity. One that has drawn him to seek other monks with totally different beliefs, primarily Buddhists. Also Hindus. And to a certain extent, Jains. Monks, then, from right across the world who, at a glance, recognise in each other that same option for the monastic life, opening wide to each other the doors of their monasteries or ashrams, unveiling in this way hitherto unknown spiritual realms of learning, offering hospitality to each other in a world where so often religion is used to justify violence. One could describe it as a love affair of sorts.
You recognize so often that the language is very, very different, but there is a deep kind of commonality that joins us. It's an expression of love for the other, of love for the stranger. Interreligious dialogue does come down to hospitality. It's showing hospitality. I always come back to the fact that ultimately it's about human relationships. It's about being in relationship with somebody who's different. But respecting the difference and recognizing the certain commonalities, but respecting that there are certain unresolvable differences that will always be there. And not making that the basis for condemning someone else as being wrong or being evil, but simply recognizing that they're different.
That was the voice of the monk with the spiritual curiosity. The Secretary General for Monastic Interreligious Dialogue for the Benedictine Confederation, who also works with Cistercians and Trappists. He's Father William Skudlarek, and he was kind enough to sit down with me here in our studios and patiently explain how monastic interreligious dialogue began as a way of bringing together Catholic or Christian monks and nuns with religions that also have a monastic order, such as those I've just mentioned. A trend, Father William explained, which in the past 10 years has broadened its approach.
Monastic is basically interpreted now as a spiritual practice or spiritual religious experience. And so what we are interested in is promoting relationships, dialogue, if you will, between spiritual practitioners, both Christian and of other religions. So that means we also engage in dialogue with Muslims, for example, who do not have a monastic order, but certainly have a spiritual practice.
I began to wonder at this point how and if the famous rule of Saint Benedict, drawn up at Monte Cassino by the founder of the Benedictines, and once described by Bossuet as an epitome of Christianity, a learned and mysterious abridgment of all the doctrines of the Gospel, all the institutions of the Fathers and all the councils of perfection, played into all this. But I didn't have to ask a Benedictine to bring that into our conversation.
As Benedict says in his rule, the monk, the Christian monk, is one who truly seeks God. And so I think monks have a kind of fascination with the different ways people have conducted the search for God and the different means they've found to help them stay on the path and move in the direction of a deeper spiritual life.
So how easy or how difficult is it, I thought, to tread on someone else's turf? Naively, I thought it was all about bringing your own baggage of solid faith and undoubting knowledge.
Now, I think what I'd have to say is, yes, it certainly is important that you're well-rooted in your own culture when you enter another culture. And then you begin to see how your cultures are different and what one can offer that maybe your own culture is lacking in, and vice versa, what you can offer another. What I found is that people can enter a relationship with another religious tradition without being all that well grounded in their own. It can go both ways, of course, but what it often does is to make the person ask some deep questions about his or her own faith.
Why brings doubt into your spiritual life.
Yes, and doubt which leads to a greater deepening of understanding of why, you know, why do I do this? Why do I believe this? So that your faith begins to seek understanding, precisely because you've seen how different it is from somebody else's approach. And then you begin to ask, now why? What do I really believe, and why do I believe it?
And what did you learn?
Oh, good question. I think I learned more than anything else that ultimately faith is a willingness to live with uncertainty and a willingness to recognize that that which we say is ultimate, that which we name God or Abba or Jesus, is ultimately beyond our ability to conceive or speak, and that we are willing to live in that mystery, call it the mystery of love, the mystery of compassion that surrounds us. Recognizing that we have a certain historical and cultural and religious way of expressing that mystery, but recognizing that ultimately it only leads us deeper into the mystery. It doesn't resolve the mystery or take the mystery away.
Being not just spiritually curious but plainly inquisitive, I asked Father William as to how his interest in intermonastic dialogue had sparked off. It seems it all began with a book by a Belgian monk focusing on Christian yoga, but that the actual breakthrough came many years later when he was based in Japan. It was 1994.
I looked upon that as an opportunity to begin a serious study of or entrance into a Buddhist way of being a spiritual person. So I got in touch with a Zendo in Kamakura in Japan and began to be trained and to practice Zazen. Sitting meditation, as it's sometimes called. So that really is my kind of, should I say, formal introduction to this interreligious dimension. I'm not academically trained in the field, and my interest is more in the area of practice.
At this point, I was convinced there must be some charismatic figures in this field of intermonastic dialogue, beyond Thomas Merton, of course.
Thomas Merton, certainly. Thomas Merton was one of those universalists. He was interested in absolutely everything. He went deeply. Bede Griffiths is another English monk who lived in India for many years.
And so it was that Father William introduced me to the world of a Frenchman from the 20th century who was a bit of a trailblazer, spending most of his life in India. His name, Henri Lesaux, you may have heard of him.
This year, at least in the area of monastic interreligious dialogue, I've had a lot of meetings, symposia, publications about a French monk named Henri Lesaux. This is the 100th anniversary of his birth. Kind of a rereading and a reappreciation of what he did.
He was a Benedictine, of course.
He was a Benedictine of the Abbey of Kergonon, Saint-Anne-de-Kergonon in Brittany. He was born in 1910, so 100 years ago, entered the monastery in 1929 and went to India in 1948. And died on December 7th, 1973. So he was
in India.
India never returned to France.
So he was dealing with Hindus.
Exactly. A kind of specific form of Hinduism I'm not all that conversant with, but a form that emphasizes non-duality, basically saying that God and the human are not separate. They're not the same, but they're not separate. They're not two. They're not one, but they're not two. It's something that really
An orthodox way of thinking?
It is, within a certain school of Hinduism. They refer to it frequently as a Vedantic form of Hinduism, whose sacred texts are the Upanishads.
From a Christian point of view, was it revolutionary at the time, because interreligious dialogue Well, it started with Pius XII's Fide Dornum in 57, but then really kicked off after Vatican II.
It was really Vatican II.
And he went there in 1948, which is before all this.
Definitely, yeah. So he is a pioneer. He is a pioneer. And was regarded, and in some circles is still regarded, as...
heretic.
I would say they wouldn't call him heretic because he always... He never in any way renounced his Christian roots. But what he was basically trying to understand was, how is it possible for my Christian faith to be true, to be a true expression of God's self-revelation and of God's way of saving us, making us fully that which we were meant to be? How is it possible for that to be true and another way to speak of God, and another way to practice one's relationship with God or to experience salvation, to also be true? And again, that is so much at odds with our Western way of thinking. Fundamental principle of Western thinking is the principle of contradiction. Two things cannot be true in the same way at the same time. And yet, Henri Lesseau is saying, I know that my Christian faith is true, but I also know that the Upanishads are true. I know it. You know, I sense it deeply. And that was a painful experience for him. He experienced being torn apart because he said, I simply cannot deny my faith in Jesus Christ. I cannot deny Jesus Christ. But at the same time, I cannot deny what I experienced to be the truth of the Upanishads, the truth of this Advaitic, as it's sometimes called, or non-dual way of understanding the ultimate, which basically does away with all historical, all cultural, all ritual expressions. It's pure consciousness.
He's a controversial character, considered controversial within the Catholic Church.
Yes, and I think the main reason was, as was the case with Jacques Dupuy, because there was a fear that people would not understand, that people would misinterpret because of the ambiguities that might have been present in some of his writings.
This is
Henri Lesseau now. Yeah,
but it doesn't refer to intermonastic and interreligious dialogue, which is above board.
Oh, yeah, definitely is.
Just to define the two areas of interest, When my chat with Father William was coming to an end, I decided to be a little pushy. So here goes. I asked my final question. What is the importance of this monastic and interreligious dialogue in today's world, in your opinion, of course?
I think the fundamental importance is that religion is ultimately about the search for God. Now, especially at the present time, interreligious dialogue is in many ways dominated by the need for a greater understanding between Islam and Christianity, between Muslims and Christians, because there are too many people who instrumentalize religion and use it for oppressive and even violent kinds of activities. So there is a great need at the present time for coming to a deeper understanding mutually between Christians and Muslims. But that frequently does remain on the level of human rights, human dignity, the need for respect, the need for living in peace and constructing peaceful coexistence with one another, all of which are extremely important and absolutely necessary. Monastic interreligious dialogue is a way of saying ultimately religion is about a spiritual life. It's about the search for God. It's about being filled with God in one's life. And that's the focus that we want to take. Not at all denying the necessity of dialogue on this more social, cultural, theological level even, but saying that ultimately what we are looking for is ways to become more holy, more fully human and more holy as religious people. We Christians, when we speak about monasticism, we seem to think that Christianity invented it. And there were Buddhist monks for a good 1,000 years before there were Christian monks. My sense is that they've had 1,000 more years of living a monastic way of life. And I should think we would have something to learn from that longer experience. And that was the reason, for example, why 4 years ago I organized a meeting between Catholic and Buddhist monks to talk about celibacy. You know, why are we celibate? What is the meaning of our celibacy? What are the practices that support a celibate way of life? And what kinds of therapies do you have, or do we have in our two traditions, for people who have offended against their promise of celibacy? And out of that, I put together some of the insights that we exchanged with one another in a book. But that
to what me, came out of it?
Some things about even what we would call dealing with temptations, a whole different way of dealing with the mind, and that sort of thing. One of the things that came out of it, I always thought that Catholics were the casuists that, you know, tried to define the very fine points of when you were offended and when you didn't, not only the sexual area, but in all other areas as well. The Buddhists go way beyond what we would do in being very careful to define exactly what constitutes a transgression and what doesn't, and what the levels of transgression are. The other thing that I found very interesting was that what we would call doing penance for a fault is very public within the Buddhist monastic tradition. I mean, the confession of one's fault is public, and the penance that one receives is public, which surprised me. We tend to deal with things much more on what we call the internal forum, a mutual confidential relationship between a confessor and a penitent, which may have been underlying some of the problems that we have experienced and known over the past couple of decades. Whereas within the Buddhist monastic tradition, both the confession of one's fault and the penance that one does for it are very public. And so all those things kind of surprised me.
Are Buddhist monks celibate too, all of them?
Well, that's a good question. In some traditions, they are. That is the authentic and deep tradition. In Japan at the present time, for example, the celibacy has almost completely disappeared from the monastic life in Japan. But in Korea, it's strong. In Thailand, in Sri Lanka, monks are celibate. But not necessarily for a lifetime, because they don't remain monks for all their life.
What I discovered in this conversation was that treading on other monks' turf can be done. But that, as Father William says, it must be done in the respect of every family and every religious group, who must have the option to set up not walls, but boundaries. My thanks there go to the Secretary General for Monastic Interreligious Dialogue for the Benedictine Confederation, Father William Skudlarek. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening.